Case number 13-3074, United States of America v. James Ordell Baxter, second appellant. Ms. Strom for the appellant, Mr. Smith for the appellee.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Cheryl Strom for the appellant, James Baxter. Mr. Baxter's 2255 motion and supplemental motion were not time-barred. First, because Mr. Baxter is entitled to equitable tolling because he relied on the actions taken by the trial judge before his one-year deadline for filing the 2255 expired, Mr. Baxter sent a letter asking for appointment of counsel. That was in September of 2009. Before the one-year deadline expired, the judge granted the request for Mr. Baxter to seek appointed counsel to represent him in the 2255 motion. However, counsel was not appointed until after the one-year statute of limitations expired for filing the 2255 motion. Appointed counsel filed a conditional appearance and also filed a motion, bare bones 2255 motion, and then for additional time to review a 7,000-page transcript and prepare an adequate 2255 motion.
So if there hadn't been a grant of the motion in November or October, I can't remember the exact date, but then would it still have been okay under equitable tolling principles? Because it seems like a prudent thing to do is just to file within the year.
Well, Mr. Baxter, again, proceeding pro se, thought that he had until January to file the 2255 motion. He didn't realize that filing the motion, the decision on the petition for reconsideration submitted to the Supreme Court did not toll his one-year statute of limitations. So he thought he was still within the time limit as he was proceeding pro se.
And just on that, so if that were all we knew, then I take it under the cases that wouldn't constitute an extraordinary circumstance that would give rise to equitable tolling. A mistaken, well, perhaps understandable, but a mistaken impression as to the deadline.
Well, even if Mr. Baxter was mistaken as to the deadline and the individuals reviewing his application thought he had until January the 11th, 2010, to file his 2255, counsel wasn't appointed and didn't enter appearance until January the 10th, 2010, which would certainly leave no one any time to review 7,000 pages and file a 2255 motion in one day. So all of the circumstances would have called for an extension of time for preparing a real 2255 motion, and one that actually can make reference to the record and identify the issues. We would take the position that an extension of time would have been required. And also, I believe, as we pointed out in our brief, the Third Circuit recently decided in United States versus Thomas, 713 Fed Third 165, Third Circuit 2013, that a judge has the authority to extend the AEDPA time limits because the 2255 is a continuation of the criminal case, and the judge has the authority to grant extensions of time in criminal proceedings. So it's just another part of the criminal case. There's nothing so extraordinary about the 2255 motion for enlargement of time that would prevent a judge from having jurisdiction to grant the authority. And in this case, the judge granted an extension of time until July the 15th of the following year for Mr. Baxter to submit his full 2255 motion, his supplement, if you will, and that was timely filed. We're also making the argument that neither the Brady claim nor the Skilling issue can be time-barred on procedural grounds. The government, we have argued, has suppressed evidence of the medical records of the bipolar disorder of Ms. Bullock and also suppressed that Ms. Bullock suffered from a bipolar disorder. And referring to a District of Columbia case, 9 U.S. Edmund EDMUND versus U.S. Attorney, 959 Fed Sup 1, D.C. Circuit, 1977, the AEDPA deadline is equitably tolled until the petitioner received the undisclosed information. Mr. Baxter has still never received the medical records regarding Ms. Bullock's bipolar disorder. In addition, Skilling cannot be denied, procedurally barred, because Mr. Baxter is actually innocent of the claim of theft of honest or deprivation of honest services because his case did not involve bribes or kickbacks.
Can I ask about that for a moment?
Mm-hmm.
He has to be under the honest service under the actual innocence requirement. He has to show it's more likely than not that he's actually innocent. Correct. That's a burden on him, right?
He has to show more likely than not. I believe. Under the body of case law that's developing under Skilling, he has to show it's more likely than not that he is actually innocent of the charge of theft of honest services.
Before we get to what he has to be actually mm-hmm. innocent of, the requirement in Boozley and Schlupp and McGuigan is all that it's the defendant's burden to show more, in light of all the, I'm just quoting, it's more likely than not that no reasonable juror would have convicted him, right?
Yes.
Now, the charge against him was not a charge of honest services fraud. The charge against him, taking the conspiracy one to begin with, was a charge of fraud with a number of alternative theories, one of which was honest services, one of which was pecuniary fraud, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, so why isn't it the case that he has to show he's actually innocent of the charge against him, not just one of the theories of the charge against him? In other words, why doesn't he have to show that no reasonable jury could have found him, a properly instructed jury, could have found him guilty of the charge in the indictment, namely fraud, on a pecuniary fraud theory, even though everybody agrees it could not have found him guilty on a theory of honest services fraud?
Well, I think what Your Honor is asking me is, now do we turn to whether the error was harmless?
No. I think there's confusion in both your brief, not your fault, I'm saying, but the government's brief as well. The government only addresses this issue in a footnote. I want to ask the government why they only address it in a footnote. But if we were to look at this as, you don't get to the harmless error question until you get to the merits, right? That is, I think the government agrees that there was, that it was timely. There's still the procedural default of not raising the Skilling-like argument. In order to get to the merits of that argument, you first have to prove actual innocence. So far, everything's correct, I'm saying, right?
I thought the government disagreed that it was timely filed, but...
Well, I'll ask again. I thought that they had agreed that it was timely.
Except for that, I agree with you, Your Honor.
In any event, you think it was timely filed?
I think it's timely filed.
Yeah. So... if you got over all of the habeas hurdles, then we would get to the question of whether there was harmless error in the wrong instruction, right?
Well, I think under McQuiggan versus Perkins, mm-hmm. which we've cited, we're presenting a claim that it is more likely than not that Mr. Baxter is actually innocent of the theory of honest services fraud.
I want to assume for the moment that you're right about that. We get over that, and now we get to the question of whether there was harmless error, right?
Right.
And on that one, it's the government's burden, right?
Yes, right.
All right. My question is, why do we get to that one? We don't get to the government's burden of showing harmless error until you overcome your burden, which requires you to prove actual innocence. That's correct. That description is correct, right?
Well, I don't see how they can be separated, Your Honor. I think if looking at the body of law following Skilling, there's no possibility that the theft or deprivation of honest services was a correct charge.
I agree
in
with
this
that.
Case.
I agree with that, and I think the government agrees with that. The question is, in order to get to that issue, you first have to get past the actual innocence question because of the defaults. And in order to do that, you have to show actual innocence. That is, you have to show that a reasonable jury would not have convicted him. And the question really is, convicted him of what? And it seems like it ought to be convicted him of what the indictment charged him with, which was a conspiracy with multiple alternatives. Why isn't that the right test? Why isn't it required that you show, more likely than not, that he was innocent not only of honest services fraud, which everybody agrees to, but also innocent of the other charge in the indictment, of the charge of the indictment that he embezzled from the union, which government does not agree with and which this court did not agree with on a direct appeal.
Well, I don't think that's the position the circuit took in United States versus Casso, where, and this was a case of plea bargaining, where the defendant had to show
I'm familiar
he was,
with that one.
Yes, I am aware of that, Your Honor.
Right, that's plea bargaining. That
right.
was a case where there was no, there was only one charge, not the alternative charge, not another charge. And in fact, we held that the defendant had to show that he was innocent, not only of the charge that was actually written on paper, but of a more serious charge that the government may have decided not to take, and probably also an equal charge. So if that's true, that in a plea bargain where there isn't even an indictment that states the actual charge, isn't it a fortiori that where the indictment charges a defendant with fraud, to show actual innocence, he has to show he didn't commit fraud. Not just that he didn't commit honest services fraud, but that he doesn't commit the kind of fraud charged in the indictment, which included stealing from the union.
Well, again, Your Honor, I don't understand how Mr. Baxter can get to his burden of proving that he would be actually innocent of the other charges without looking at whether the honest deprivation of honest services actually affected the outcome of the trial. That would, I think, funnel down into whether it is a reasonable probability that he would not have been convicted of the fraud charges based on another theory.
I think you're right. I think these are two are intertwined, but the difference is who has the burden. And if we let you get to the merits, then the government has the burden. But in Schlupp and McGuigan and Boosley, the question is, do you get to the merits? And you only do that if you overcome actual innocence. To take the Boosley example, maybe it's an even easier one to say. The statute used to say that it was a crime to use or carry a gun in connection with a drug trafficking offense, right? And the court held that, and people were charged, often with both. And the court held that if you had a gun near you, but you not on you, that did not constitute using, right? So you could be actually, this is a slight oversimplification, but under those circumstances, you were actually innocent of the using charge. But if you had been charged with both using and carrying, and the evidence was that you had the gun in your hand, I don't see how you could show actual innocence just by showing that you didn't use. You'd still carry it.
Well, I think one of the problems with Mr. Baxter's burden at the moment is he had no evidentiary hearing on his 2255 motion. Okay, he has produced an affidavit saying, I was not part of this scheme between Bullock and Hemphill to defraud the union of money. I was entitled to what I was receiving in the way of paychecks. He's listed a whole litany. He's made his claim.
Well, but those are not, that none of that is new evidence, right? That was the evidence, that was his argument at trial.
Well, but my position would be that the deprivation of honest services theory kept Mr. Baxter off the witness stand, that it would be impossible for Mr. Baxter to take the witness stand to defend himself with the honest services charge in place or a theory in place as the law stood at the time of his trial, when the theory was he had a fiduciary duty to the union, he had a fiduciary duty to
the
teachers.
Why would it keep him off the stand? I'm not following.
Because I'm not sure how, with that charge looming or that theory looming, Mr. Baxter could have taken the stand and said, yes, it's true that I was pretty much a no-show at the union. Yes, it's true that I signed all of these blank checks and then sent them off, and I don't know what people filled in after I signed the blank checks. He would have to have admitted all of that, which certainly would have put him in the jackpot as far as theft of honest services.
Put him in the jack what?
Jackpot.
In the jackpot. Okay, but if we had a not new trial now and we took out honest services and he's charged only with fraud by embezzling from the union, you're saying he would get on the stand and say, yes, I signed all these fake checks. Yes, I put all this money into another bank account. Yes, I did all these things. Now I'm happy to tell you that. it doesn't really work because he just admitted embezzlement.
Well, what he said in his affidavit is the money I got I was entitled to. Okay, it was agreed that I would continue to get a salary even though I was working in the mayor's office because I was performing services for the union. It was agreed I would get a pension, and there was testimony it was agreed he would get a pension. It was agreed I could write off my car expenses. It was agreed my automobile would be paid for. What we're really down to when we get through what the other witnesses agreed to are the wizard tickets and the painting. And the, as part of his 2255 motion, Mr. Baxter has submitted two affidavits from people in positions to assist the union, people in government in D.C. in positions to assist the union, who said Mr. Baxter took us to Wizard games. And by the way, when we knew it, when we went, we knew he was doing it as part of his position with the union. He was essentially lobbying us or...
All right, so how is that an admission against his interests with respect to honest services? His argument is, I'm not sure how relevant this part of it.
No, I'm talking about pecuniary. I'm talking about pecuniary.
Yeah, but he could have, why couldn't he have said that at his trial? Why couldn't he have said
that? And offered the witnesses.
And offered the witnesses even more so.
Well, we've claimed his attorney was ineffective for failing to interview
the
witnesses.
That's a different argument, but I'm still on the skilling problem, not on the. I understand your argument about ineffective assistance. That seems different.
So we have two claims. One, we never got the evidentiary hearing to which we were entitled for Mr. Baxter to prove
ineffective assistance.
Ineffective assistance of counsel, and there's a reasonable probability. Had all of the evidence been introduced that he's now able to muster, they would not have been convicted on a pecuniary fraud either, but we didn't get the evidentiary hearing.
Okay. We'll hear from the government.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Peter Smith on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, there is no need to remand this case. With the exception of defendant's skilling claim, appellant's claims are time-barred.
So you agree that that's not time-barred, right?
We agree. He filed his 2255 motion within 12 months of the Supreme Court decision, making that claim timely. His other claims are time-barred, and I did want to briefly address that. Appellant didn't file either an extension request or his 2255 petition until after the expiration of the 12-month period, and appellant's counsel this morning was saying that the district court had granted an extension request within that period, and that if that is what appellant's argument is, that's incorrect. He wrote a letter to the district court requesting the appointment of counsel. That did not request an extension. It simply requested the appointment of counsel. That was within the 12-month period, but if the court looks at the docket makes clear that there was no order entered as to any of appellant's requests for relief until after the expiration of the 12-month period.
Well, there was an order that counsel would be appointed.
No.
No, I thought that was within the 12
months.
Yes,
correct. And I can, just to make things easier, the relevant docket pages are Appendix 40 and 41. And there's no order there, and I think what appellant is citing in his reply brief is his own affidavit, which is simply incorrect. He's incorrect that the court granted him relief within the 12-month period, and that explains why the Thomas case is inapplicable. The circuits are split on this issue to begin with, but even if you went with the rule that's in Thomas, the case appellant is citing, in Thomas moved within the 12-month period for an extension. The question there was that extension request effective? Mm-hmm. And the Third Circuit said it was. The Second Circuit has said it's not because there's no motion. There's no 2255 petition pending. So that's our argument as to the time bar. With respect to equitable tolling, and I'll be very brief in this, because appellant never moved for an extension of time within the 12-month period, his case is very similar to Thomas and McDade in that it's just a garden variety failure to calendar the date properly. And appellant makes that clear in his affidavit that he filed with the district court. It's at Appendix page 410. He says, I misunderstood the deadline, and that's why we didn't file on time. And that's simply, under McDade, not permissible. That's not a basis for equitable tolling. The court has no further questions about the time bar argument. I did want to address.
Okay, but you're accepting the proposition that actual innocence, depending on how one shows that, would get around the time bar. No?
If there were actual innocence.
That's right,
yeah.
Of course.
Well, the ADEPA's time bar, I guess, because that would be, well, I think he would still have to have a basis for equitable tolling, and I understood the court's discussion.
The opinions frame it in the alternative, it seems to me, that equitable tolling or actual innocence. No?
I guess I'm a little confused because I thought the earlier discussion of actual innocence was framed in the context of appellant's Skilling claim, and the government agrees that that was not time-barred under the AEDPA. And there the question was there cause and prejudice to overcome procedural bar under Boosley, which was a separate argument. So maybe I'm misunderstanding the court's question, but the actual innocence would overcome any bar as to appellant's Skilling claim.
Why does not the same principle govern his money laundering claim without getting into the facts on it?
Right.
In other words, that, as I understand it,
is a base
an actual innocence claim. It may be a failing one for a variety of reasons, but it is an actual innocence claim.
And right. Your question would be that would excuse compliance with the 12-month limitations period in the statute.
Yes. Right?
It could be. It could be the basis.
The law is pretty clear about this. Cause and prejudice or actual innocence. Right? To overcome a procedural bar, cause and prejudice, cause maybe equitable tolling, prejudice, et cetera, or actual innocence. And that's the position you've taken in your briefs.
No, I agree with that. I guess where I'm getting hung up, and I don't want to, if I don't know the answer,
Very good appellate advocacy.
Where I don't want to take up the court's time with this question. Yeah. I guess where I'm getting hung up is the difference between the time bar and in the statute, the AEDPA, as opposed to the procedural bar that's discussed in Boosley and its progeny. And I
guess the relevant question is, what's the salient distinction between the Skilling claim and the money laundering claim for purposes of this issue? Because it seems like actual innocence would get you over the one-year bar as to either.
And I think that courts have announced principles similar to those, and it wasn't briefed in this way. That's why I'm sort of struggling to respond. And
isn't that what McGuigan holds? McGuigan is a case where he didn't come within the one-year bar, and the court says you can still overcome it by actual innocence.
Yeah, and I guess they're saying there that that's the basis for equitable tolling. Or maybe I'm wrong about that, but I understand the proposition that actual innocence, the courts have allowed where...
Not just the courts, but
the court.
We hold that actual innocence, if proved, serves as a gateway through which a petitioner may pass whether the impediment is a procedural bar, as was in Schleppenhaus, or as in this case, the expiration of the statute of limitations. This seems like an easy question.
Okay.
So you can say yes to this.
I agree.
Right. Now, can we talk about the Skilling question, which is somewhat harder, okay? So that is the actual innocence argument with respect to that. Am I not correct that in order to get to the merits issue, that is whether or not erroneous Skilling instruction tainted this trial or whether it was harmless, he first has to show actual innocence of fraud, including both theories.
I would agree with that.
So why do you only say that in a footnote?
Well,
it seems like you spent a lot of time showing. Well, you reference that. And I think it's fair to let you say that you incorporate the argument, but you spent a lot of time arguing about why this would be only harmless error. You concede it's error, but would only be harmless. But that puts the burden on the government when the rule with respect to actual innocence puts the burden on the – I appreciate that habeas is complicated. There's no doubt about that. On the other hand, we have to get this right as to what the threshold – how you get past the gates here.
No, I having listened to the court's suggestion earlier, and I mean, I understand that point, and I agree with it, and I think that, you know, I apologize that the government's brief wasn't more clear. I think that we wrote it in a sense backwards, meaning that we wrote it that way because we thought that the underlying factual reasons were the same. In other words, the conduct...
They are the same. I agree with that. The question is who has the burden. That's what's really important.
And I agree with that, and it's unfortunate that we put that in a footnote, and having the opportunity now to think about it at argument, I think we should have expanded that section, and then in the harmlessness, we should have said, hey, it's harmless for the reasons we already said with respect to
actual...
I want to
be sure I'm not missing something here. Am I missing something?
No, I don't think so. I think that that's correct, and I think that that's consistent with Boosley, that you have to overcome the procedural bar, and then you can get to the merits question, and then on the merits question, we're agreeing that there's error, and then we're arguing that the error is harmless. So I agree with the court, and it was just because the question of actual innocence to us and the question of the conduct that made any error harmless was the same. We wrote our brief that way. But I agree with the presupposition that the court must first address the procedural bar, and I also agree that what we should have done in our brief is to front load that argument and then refer back in the harmless section. But, you know, I think as we agree, the underlying conduct is the same. And that conduct was addressed at length in the resolution of appellant's direct appeal, and we've cited in our brief, but there are many examples of conduct that was pecuniary fraud, that was appellant's conduct, not just the co-conspirator's conduct, but appellant's conduct. Pages 1362 and 1363 of the court's opinion on direct appeal lists some of the things appellant Baxter did that reflected mail and wire fraud.
You're out of time. I have some questions for you.
Absolutely.
Not only allowed but required to keep on answering as long as I have questions.
As if he didn't know that.
on the money laundering claim, it's clear from the statute you have to have proceeds, right?
Yeah, I think that's yes.
Yeah. And then the statute begins by saying, whoever knowing that the property involved in a financial transaction represents the proceeds of some form of unlawful activity, then so on. So I take it from that money laundering only kicks in at the point where you have the proceeds of an unlawful transaction.
I think I agree with that.
In other words, there is a sequence issue. And until you have an unlawful transaction yielding proceeds, you can't have money laundering. You agree?
I think, yes. I think so.
I think that's the only reading that makes any sense.
I think that's right.
Okay. So my first factual question for you is, where do we have the proceeds? What's the first point at which we have the proceeds of an unlawful transaction?
Well, there are different ways to answer the question because there were different schemes by which...
I know. Take one.
One would be the fraudulent charges on the charge card. That would be the proceeds. Using the charge card erroneously for personal purchases is the proceeds, and then the argument and would be...
Is that in itself fraud? In other words, at the point where she uses the charge card for fur coats, etc., it's entirely possible that she will reimburse. She'll either pay the Amex bill herself, or she'll reimburse the union, right? So do we have the proceeds are the fur coat? What? I mean, I guess this is the question of what they are, and how we have any unlawful transaction at that point.
I understand that one could spin out a theory where those would be not be fraudulent charges. I think that this court has resolved this question both as to the charges themselves and as to the broader claim about whether there was money laundering in this case, because the co-defendants raised the sufficiency of money laundering in their direct appeal, and this court
They raised it in a rather odd form, objecting to the admissibility of bits of evidence and so forth. It's not clear to me that the direct appeal actually focuses on the question of what evidence is needed for a money laundering claim.
I agree that it doesn't go that far, but it does list some of the examples that I would list today in the argument.
Okay, well, let's go on with them.
Okay.
It seemed to me in looking at the case that perhaps the best appearance of proceeds of an unlawful transaction is the money going to Expressions Unlimited, which seems to be it's not to meet any union need at all. It seems to be entirely for the purpose of getting money out of the union into the hands of the perpetrators. So let's assume that's the proceeds of an unlawful transaction. I think that's safe. But then what do we have that's laundering after that?
Can I just pause and just interrupt for one second? If I look at the indictment and the chart of money laundering, it seems to me that the government's position is exactly described as Judge Williams put it, because it says in parentheses, proceeds of WTU checks written to Expressions Unlimited, and that was then, I take it, I'm assuming what your argument is going to be, but the proceeds are as Judge Williams suggests. If there are any proceeds here, they are
money in the hands of Expressions Unlimited.
Yes, and Leroy Holmes, the chauffeur. That would be the other one.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, maybe you're presaging my response, or maybe I'm misunderstanding, but
all I'm doing is confirming that both of you are correct as to what is so, and not correct in the sense that that's what the government said in its indictment.
It did, and yeah.
Then where do we have the actual behavior that constitutes the laundering?
Well, I guess this court's opinion.
In other words, let me just to pursue it or suggest a problem I think you have. The subsequent transactions seem to be primarily aimed at getting the money out to individual conspirators. No?
Correct.
Right. And that, at least at Defahinti, says that's not enough.
When there's direct, Defahinti, I think, says supposing that you take the fraudulent proceeds, which is a check, and you deposit those into your own bank account directly, there's no effort at concealment.
Right.
There's no...
That's the facts
right.
of Defahinti.
Right. There's nothing that
right.
conceals the source of those proceeds. And here you had, you did have mechanisms or efforts to conceal the provenance of those funds. You had checks to Leroy Holmes, more than $1 million in checks written to the chauffeur, Leroy Holmes, who then...
Well, then you're switching a little, aren't you? I mean, we were with Expressions Unlimited.
Correct.
So, but now we're... Well, are we dropping Expressions Unlimited?
No, I think it's the same. The mechanism is the same, where you have the check itself is the fraudulent proceed, and it's laundered through Expressions Unlimited and back to the co-conspirators, or a check is...
You get the money out in the form of a check to Expressions Unlimited, and then they disperse it for the benefit of the perpetrators, right? Now, in the case of Bullock, at least, the dispersion takes the form of satisfying the Amex bill.
Correct.
Right?
And I guess...
So, I mean, is that... It's the Amex card that she has, right? I mean, Where exactly is the concealment?
Well, I think that that is the concealment, and that does satisfy the case, and because you don't have the situation where either the Amex charges or the checks are being directly deposited into a bank account, as in Adefahinti. You have, I mean, I understand what you're arguing.
The money is used to satisfy her debt.
But it's going through Expressions Unlimited, and it's not going directly.
We need that step to get the proceeds.
Is it different because if it were her personal Amex card, then there would be no concealment of the second step. It would look like she was taking money. She had gotten money fraudulently, put it in her bank account,
right,
and used it for her personal expense. But here, she's making it look like she's paying her union credit card, paying back with her personal money, when actually she's paying the union credit card back with the union's money.
Correct.
So, and there, is that where the concealment is?
I guess all of these things, and by all of these things I mean some of the things that are listed in the government's brief, were efforts to conceal. But that would be one. Another would be.
Maybe the government can win in such cases on really stupid efforts to conceal. But I have to say, at best, this strikes me as such an effort, because here you have charges incurred on the Amex card that are clearly not for the union, and the money is used to pay that bill, and it's her card. Where's the concealment? It's hard for me to see even a stupid effort at concealment there.
Well, it seems to me that the efforts they made to cover up, to move money around in order to pay the bill.
You move off into generalities.
Well,
what transactions are you speaking of?
Well, okay, for example, appellant had an American Express card that was in, I believe to be in WTU's name, in the Washington Teachers Union's name. That was for official purchases. He used those for personal purposes,
right,
but he didn't pay those bills directly. They moved money around so that the provenance of the funds used to pay the Amex bills was not clear. For example, they gave money to an excessive amount of money to the chauffeur Leroy Holmes, took it back, and then paid the bills, so that by moving this money around, its provenance was unclear, and it wasn't obvious to anybody who wanted to look that was a theft that was coming from WTU funds. And that is
if you're switching to Holmes, then I get it's the money in Holmes's hands that is the proceeds, right?
I think the proceeds are when they initially write the checks or they use the American Express bill. And I understand Your Honor's suggestion.
I have real objection to using the American Express account.
Right. And I understand that you seem to differ with that. You're saying that there could be an alternative explanation, and that may not itself be the fraud. And I guess I have two responses.
It's certainly not a fraud which has fully matured.
Right. It's not completed, is what you're suggesting. I understand that. And I guess my two responses are, one, that there were various efforts made by the co-conspirators to hide the provenance of funds, and that itself satisfies Adefahinti. And the second is that in the posture of this case, where appellant has raised this in the context of a 2255 petition, all of these things are his burden to show. It's not the direct appeal, and even then it would be his burden to show error, but it's a collateral challenge where he's got to show.
Well, if it had been properly raised in the trial, it would not have been. The government would have had harmless error as a backstop, but nothing more.
And I guess what my response boils down to is that it's his burden to show all these things. And one could spin out theories where the charges themselves perhaps were not a completed fraud, but I just don't think appellant is entitled to that in the posture of this case. And even if that were correct, I still think you have enough different examples in the government's trial evidence, and even in this court's opinion in Hemphill, that the court could still sustain appellant's money laundering convictions, because you have all of these different efforts to hide the provenance of the funds.
Assuming that characterization, which is the point where I have.
I know, and I understand that that's only a partial response to your question.
Incidentally, has the government waived that it can the requirement of a certificate of appealability and the meeting of the grounds for a certificate of appealability?
I don't think so. What happened was...
You didn't raise it. You have a footnote describing what happened, but you don't say that we can't hear this case until we issue such a certificate.
Sure. What happened before this panel had the case in terms of the merits brief
was to the merits panel.
Right. The appellant moved for a certificate of appealability. The government opposed, and the court issued an order that the parties would just address the merits and the certificate of appealability together.
But you didn't.
I mean, I understand what you're saying, and I guess it's similar to the mistake we made with actual innocence, where we thought since our reasons were the same, that our brief would have looked the same regardless. But in this case,
this is a lower. It's the opposite problem. In the other case, the defendant's burden is higher on getting through the procedural default than it is on the merits. In this case, the defendant's burden is lower on getting through the certificate of appealability. Right? All he has to show is that jurists of reason, which apparently we are, I hope, would find this to be a debatable case. So, if you win on the merits, you have to win on. This is a lower burden.
No, I understand that, and I guess unless I'm really missing something, I suppose the court could grant the certificate of appealability, but then find there's no need to remand for the reasons that we say.
I think that's what we would have to do, right?
We'd have to grant it. That's jurisdictional.
Right. We first have to grant it.
Oh, I see what you're saying. I guess my two responses are we didn't waive it because of the way that it arrived at this court, the posture of it, and the fact that we did reference that this was our response, although I appreciate Judge Williams' point about we didn't specifically address it. We just referenced the procedural posture. I would argue that's enough. And in any event, and I don't know whether, given your point about the jurisdictional question, whether this really pertains, but it's certainly well established that the court won't remand where the remand is simply ministerial. If the remand is simply for the district court to find that to enter an order denying either the COA in that case or the 2255 petition, the court doesn't typically do that.
That suggests that the grounds for issuance of the certificate must be a waivable issue. Waivable by the government, right? Because it would be preposterous to say that a court that is ready to find the government prevails on the merits
can't say that because
the government has failed to argue the other point.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, and if it's jurisdictional, I don't think that point obtains.
Yeah.
There are no further questions. We urge the court to affirm the judgment of the district court. Thank you very much.
Mr. Baxter did request an application for COA in the district court, and it was denied. So there would be no reason to remand to the district court on a COA issue. I would ask the court to consider that this is not a case where the only reasonable explanation for the verdict was pecuniary fraud. And also in the Second Circuit, although I apologize, I don't have the case with me, Second Circuit has entertained a Skilling challenge even in a petition for writ of quorum nobis. Now, you can't be more further outside of the AEDPA statute of limitations than a petition for quorum nobis. You've even finished your sentence. They did take it up, and it was not time barred or procedurally barred. The government has made theft of honest services a central figure.
Can I ask, in that case, was there only a charge of honest services fraud, or was there also a charge of pecuniary fraud?
I'm not 100% sure, Your Honor, but I think it is more my best recollection. It was only honest services fraud, but I'm not 100% certain. However, in this case, it is so intertwined that I respectfully suggest this panel could not with any certainty say that the conviction did not rest on the honest services fraud. It was simply a central figure in the case, according and at the request of the government. The first count of the indictment, paragraph 2, refers to officers and employees who occupied positions of trust in relation to WTU who owed a fiduciary duty to hold money and property solely for the benefit of WTU. Count 1, paragraph 24 and B, in discussing wire fraud and mail fraud, deprivation of honest services theory is presented again. Counts 2 to 6, wire fraud and deprivation of honest services are referred to. Counts 7 through 9, mail fraud and deprivation of honest services are discussed in the indictment. And when the judge summarized the charges at the opening of the trial on day 3-6-9-2005, page 431, he pointed out that each defendant was charged with an artifice to defraud and deprive Washington Teachers Union of money and property, as well as the union's intangible right to defendants' honest services. The government's opening statement, the government said Mr. Baxter knew what was going on. He was participating. He was profiting despite his fiduciary obligation to the union and to protect the treasury. The government's closing argument said Mr. Baxter did not come to the office of the union every day. He was working somewhere else. He said Mr. Baxter was too lazy and totally disinterested in whether the vouchers he was signing were complete, and Mr. Baxter didn't care. Appendix 331, the government's closing fraud counts and discussing those, he said the purpose was to steal from the union to cover it up, and here, and the government used the word importantly, to deprive the union of the honest services of its employees, its officers, its treasurer, its accountant. On page 357, the government, in closing, said, who would act like James Baxter if he was providing honest services to the teachers, to the union? Page 359, what kind of people were protecting the union are these? And the charge to the jury, and this is, I apologize, not in the appendix. I didn't realize the charge went over 2 days. Starting on page 7058, went over the conviction theory for conviction and discussed to deprive the Washington Teachers Union of honest services. Then at the government's request, the judge gave a Pinkerton charge so that if they convicted Baxter of count one on a theory of honest services, they could convict him on all other charges, other counts in which he was mentioned. On page 7067, the judge instructs on the theft of honest services in connection with wire fraud count. On page 7068, he describes the scheme to defraud defined as includes a plan or course of action intended to deceive or cheat another out of money, property or intangible right to honest services. Page 7069 deprives deprivation of another of intangible right to honest services. Page 707 intent to defraud to deprive others of right of honest services. Page and the appendix at 404 and 405, the judge instructs on the duties of the union officers who occupied a position of trust. On page 505, he instructs on the fiduciary duty of the officers to the union under the Constitution of the union. So the invalid theory of honest services had been in this case from the beginning of the indictment until the charge to the jury. Therefore, this court cannot be confident that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and we argue for those reasons we've met our burden of proof on actual innocence.
Thank you very much. We'll take the case under submission. We'll take a brief recess while the parties for the next case move up.